Now, can you hear me?
There we go.
Hey, how are ya?
Good. How you doing?
I have no complaints. Let me just turn everything off on my devices so you don't get any interference, because, you know, I know how it works.
No problem. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Darren, thanks.
Good to see you. Good to see you, Darren. Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Talk Recovery Radio, coming to you live on 100.5 FM. You were usually in the studio, but for those of you that are listening to us on the radio, you're listening to last week's show. And special thanks to Kimmett for replaying our show. And you can catch us on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube. And don't forget to follow us at talkrecoveryradio.com, where you can replay all of our shows. Darren, how have you been?
I can't complain. I really can't. I'm especially feeling pretty fortunate, but at the same time, a little bit of personal conflict around just the changes and how I can be better. It's too easy to sit here in Canada and just sit and watch what's going on in the world on TV and think that I can't do anything. And I'm struggling with the idea of what I can do in my personal life. And so, yeah, I think he asked me that, how are you doing, last week? And I got some ideas, and I'm pretty stoked that Mike is on the air with us today too. Cause I think if I needed to hear anyone say anything, it's probably this guy. I think there's so much to talk about today, and really help, like, I think we need to get right into this.
Yes, usually we start the show with some hot topics, but I pressed the wrong button and we added Mike to the show right away, so we're gonna just skip the hot topics for today. Mike's the hot topic. Yeah. And just, you know, on a side note, just watch the Disney Channel, Darren. I just Netflix, like the news, just no more. Just Disney Channel all the way.
Oh, yeah.
We bring you two guests every week later on in the show. We've got a good topic, overdoses, naloxone, and politics. So that's going to be interesting. But Darren, who do we got on screen with us? Mr. Mike Diamond, what is the story today?
Yeah, again, welcome to Talk Recovery. We got Mike Diamond with us today. I'm just going to go through the list here of reality TV star, Inc. series. I was looking at, there's comedian in there, entrepreneur, life coach, athlete, author, interventionist, Guinness World Record holder, father. Have I left anything out?
No, that's pretty much it. I'm out of my mind.
I mean, that's awesome. So I'm just gonna say the book, 7 Steps to an Unbreakable Mindset, is what you've authored just recently. It's a new book.
That's that book's 18 months old. I just literally wrote a new book during the pandemic. It took me 6 weeks to write it, and it's going to be called A Dose of Positivity: How to Find Purpose and learn to bend, not break, through the hurricanes of life.
Okay, so sweet. Because what a segue into my first question. I don't think we need to qualify your story of addiction. I mean, I was reading up that it looked like you had a relationship with the late Scott Weiland from Stone Temple Pilots. I could only assume that between the two, you spilt more dope than I used. So enough said on that. I really want to, you know, get your perspective and ideas around life today for people. Like you said, the pandemic, the chaos in the States, the Black Lives Matter movement, just in the conversations that I'm having, mindsets of despair, gloom, fear, and what I'm sort of dealing with is like a self-actualization of who I am and part of my identity not based on any choice, just where I was born, you know, and whatever the universe and the ignorance that I naturally have with that. And it, like I say, I question, you know, my role as an individual, and it's pessimistic at best. I'm not at risk for overdose. I'm not at risk for the COVID or being shot by police, natural disasters, poverty, you know, what do I do? Like, what does an individual in my situation do that isn't just nothing? And what should I be looking at within myself?
Well, it's a really good question. So I look at it like this. So right now, we go through a global pandemic. I'm in LA. I'm about 30 minutes from Hollywood. And a lot of my friends in New York, I lived in New York a long time, have lost their businesses. So we're being told to go inside, right, and lock down. But what we're being really told to do is go inside ourselves.
Yeah.
This is a global reset. And a lot of people are freaking out because they don't take time to go inside themselves. And when you talk about self-actualization, you're talking about Abraham Maslow talks about self-actualization. And he said that only 3% of people actually self-actualize.
Okay.
Now, I don't agree with that. I believe with the right tools, people can close the gap from where they are to where they want to be if they have purpose.
Okay, purpose.
Now, we're going through a global pandemic. Okay, so people are told to come inside and they're freaking out. I went through September 11th. There was no internet. I was a guy from Australia with nothing, watching the buildings come down. And I go, wow, I'm not going to go back to Australia. I'm going to sit through this and figure it out. So when we're under stress, any kind of stress, there's people either go inside and process and take massive action. Some people just completely freeze,
right?
Worst case scenario. Some people become aggressive and fight out because they take it personal. But this is not a personal pandemic.
Totally.
This is a global pandemic.
Yeah.
Right? So we're all affected on a massive scale. Now, if we look at cause and effect, and we remove politics, we remove sex, we remove race, we just remove everything, and we say, look, deep down, it's been spoken about since the beginning of time. There is a source that works through all of us, that connects us all. Napoleon Hill talked about an infinite intelligence. Socrates, the great Stoics, talked about it. There is something that moves through us. Now, in a global pandemic, do we slow down and start to look at our needs and wants and say, do I really need the BMW or do I want the BMW? I may need transport. So we have to simplify our needs and our wants and do the spiritual work now. And it's telling us to do the spiritual work. You know what I'm saying? But people are watching, binge watching the tiger guy, the tiger, right? And on TikTok.
That's important.
Right. But think about this. I lost 200 speaking gigs this year.
Right.
200. I wrote a program, a youth program. My book's doing great. I lost 200 speaking gigs. I just sat alone in a meditation and I said, okay, I got to figure this out. I wrote the new book in 6 weeks. Now, the great thing is this. If it wasn't for the pandemic, I wouldn't have written a new book.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, here's the best thing. Purpose. I inspire, educate, and motivate. I learn to live, love, and matter. Purpose is about me bringing you guys value, not about me. It's about being of service. Any person that can be successful, there's three motivating things. People say, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money, and I don't have enough resources. Okay, how are you spending your 24 hours? Bring value to other people, right? And be of service, you'll make money.
Yeah.
Right? And be resourceful.
So I'm on point with that. I've heard service through the process of getting clean. When I think of, you know, people that I got clean with ODing lately, I I sort of go inside and think, what, like, why, like, what's different? Why am I different? And I'm feeling a very natural and deep desire to help other people. And you learn that sort of through obedience in any program. It's sort of like, it's pounded into people. You got to help others. You got to help others. And it wasn't natural in the beginning. Is that a learned thing that you develop later on? Or do you think that's with us as a human spirit and from birth? And it's just sort of, you either go through a path where you're revisiting that, or like, does everybody have this, that in them?
I think everyone does. And I'll tell you why. I think human beings are motivated in two ways: avoid pain and gain pleasure.
Yeah.
Now, if you've suffered a massive amount of trauma in the first part of your life and you've only been dealt scarcity, to have that spiritual shift and realize that there's abundance in the world, right? And you're taking that trauma and that post-traumatic stress over and over and over and over again. You know, we all need a dose, right? D-O-S-E, dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphin. They're the happy chemicals of the brain.
Yeah.
Now, for me, I got my happy chemicals through cocaine, dope, and drinking.
Yep.
So when I was spiritually at a rock bottom and I felt, you know what, it doesn't feel good, I want to get a different dose. So my values and rules changed. Every person has in them, right, in them, the need to do good. But if you suffer massive trauma, you're so afraid to put yourself out there and do the right thing, because maybe you never received that love and appreciation. You're like, if I put myself out there, what happens if they reject me?
Yeah.
So I'm not afraid of being rejected by anyone, because I've done that spiritual work. I can put, look, when I first started to talk about my story and my use and everything, people were like, no one's ever going to employ you. You're out of your mind. You're talking about doing dope, smoking crack. Yeah. I'm the busiest guy there is, because if a young kid at a school, they need a speaker, who do they hire? They hire me over a doctor, because they're going to relate to me, not some guy that went to Stanford.
That's right.
It's one of those things that, you know, I remember starting my recovery journey and then relapsing. And there was that moment in time where I was just like, why did this happen? Why couldn't I stay clean? You know, I did the steps, I did the work and all that. But it's interesting, because like, just thinking about changing doesn't really make the change. You know, it's like, you have to actually do. And a lot of it was fear, what you just said. It's like, if I put myself out there and I make these changes, you know, and the program I worked in, you know, you do step 6 and 7 and you try to work on your character defects and assets. I was afraid, you know, possibly, and it just kept on getting the same results. So there's stages of recovery, and there's stages of what people's goals are. We want everyone to have better health outcomes, and the choices there on how they're going to get there. How are some of the ways, there's some people that listen to our show whose loved ones are still out there using and maybe not living the best life they can. What are some tips or suggestions you do as a recovery coach to try to, you can't trick somebody into changing, or can you? How do you inspire someone to change?
I work on two very simple things. If what you're doing up into this moment, so all of us, whoever's listening, or you and I here, we have to have this responsibility that I have manifested my reality up into this point by how I choose to think, feel, and act. Now, the information I've gathered for the first part of my life is different to you guys. I was born in Australia. I was abused. I was kicked out of school. I have a different map of reality, but I've still chosen to make these choices. If I can be honest and take responsibility and say, okay, I'm here because I've chosen. I can't blame my parents. I can't blame the school. It's how I've sorted the information, good or bad. First thing I work on is, are you happy right now? If you're not happy, right, let's look at that. And are you anxious? If you've got full of anxiety and you're full of happiness, let's just work on that. So let's look at what you're doing what are you watching, what are you reading, and what are you consuming? Drugs, alcohol, food.
Cutting out a little bit.
It's different risk. And then, sorry, what is it? It cut out?
Yeah, it cut out a little bit.
You're back now. It's all good.
You're good now.
Okay, sorry. So I say to someone, let's do this. When I got sober, it was simple. I did not tell people I would never use again. What I did is I was done. It was a spiritual epiphany. I looked at Scott's life. I looked at mine. I said, you know what? I'm just going to give this sober thing a try. I'd been sober on and off before. I was making a ton of money. I was shooting a VH1 show. I helped put together Miami Ink. Like, superficially, it was great, but I didn't feel good. It's like, I just don't feel good. I'm not enjoying doing an 8-ball of cocaine anymore and drinking. And I just went to a meeting and I shut up. I just shut up and I just listened. And I went to people that had more time than me, that had 14 years. And I said, okay, what are you doing? What's your blueprint? They're like, go to meetings. Don't talk for the first 90 days. Just go to meetings.
Yeah.
Okay. What do I do? They said, give out coffee. Okay. What else? Read these parts of the book. Okay. I went through the book voraciously. Start this step. Do it. I did the fourth step. Everyone was like, oh my God, the fourth step. I'm like, all right, I had to write down my resentments and I'm making amends list. All right, I pissed a lot of people off. I had to do a sexual inventory. I realized I had sex with most of the girls drunk and high. I wasn't really a good guy sexually. So I wasn't afraid to, I was like, all right. I found it really comfortable in an AA meeting. I'll tell you why. It's like going to jail and people saying, I shouldn't be here. You got caught. It's okay. You're around a bunch of drunks. You can say whatever you want. Just let it go. It's all good. It's an AA meeting. It's anonymous. So I would just go in, share if I had to, shut my mouth. And one person told me, he said, use the program like you use drugs and alcohol. And I was like, done. I'm all in. I never questioned it. I just went in. And I didn't tell myself I wouldn't drink and do drugs again. I just listened. I just listened to people that had more time. And that was it. And I just shut up. If they told me to do something, I didn't go, yeah, but no problem. I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do the commitment. Go, sorry.
I'm just, because I don't want to say it's so unique, you know, that sort of interpretation of the very beginning that, you know, how willing and absorbent you were. But generally speaking, it's excuses and whining and denial and narrow-mindedness, closed-mindedness. What is it, do you think, about yourself at that moment that made it, you know, that experience versus the general experience of in and out and relapse and back and forth and, you know, oh, there's the God word. I can't, you know, like just shut right off. Is it a willingness? Is it a...
I think we're all born with intuition. And I think the first part of our life, wherever we're born, you have an authentic self. And depending on the dysfunctional family system, it depends on what you had to bury in the first part of your life to be authentic and follow your intuition. To follow your intuition and take the road less traveled takes courage.
Yeah.
So we all know what we should do deep down. Okay. We all do. We all have that sense, right?
Yeah.
Now,
100%.
Even when
it's going to go bad.
Exactly. See what I'm saying? Now, here's the difference. Anyone can have faith in the feast, but who has faith in the famine? Who can really go into the eye of the storm and say, okay, everyone wants a trophy now for running out of a burning building. But what about the people running into the building? You got to face your shit. You got to be a firefighter. You got to go deep and figure out why you're making these disempowering choices. And I have to take responsibility as a human. Now, I'm not 12 years old. If you're a 12-year-old kid and you're using drugs and you're from the inner city and you're being beaten and abused, hey, you have no mentors. You're in a really tough situation.
Yeah.
You may not... You have to then get an indirect mentor. You have to think greater than your environment. All I did is always thought greater than my environment. I didn't worry about why it was happening. I was like, how can I grow from this experience?
So I want to touch on that because you mentioned, you know, working a program for the youth. You know, in this up here in British Columbia, Canada, you know, the opioid overdose epidemic, and just firing harm reduction, you know, solutions at it, with a separate division, you know, between, you know, abstinence based treatment. And then, you know, these ideas of education, and I mean, I can't get my mind around, like, if I was to ask you right now, while you were in your grips, near your bottom, you know, downward spiral, you may say, and most people do, it's, you know, it's because of my upbringing, my dad whooped me, my mom wasn't there, you know, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And yet, it would probably be the same reason if I, you know, talking to you now, how driven you are, how focused you are, you know, like, it's the same answer, isn't it? Because of where I came from.
Yep.
So I guess my question is, all of the education we can provide for how to get off drugs or what to do when you're spiraling, it seems to me like that's after the fact, that really the preparation for our youth should be, who's your mentors? How do you build resilience in yourself? Like, how do you already start the thought of, okay, if your parents aren't doing what healthy parents should do, what are you going to do about it as an individual, rather than complain and excuse your behavior for it? Is that a pipe dream?
No, it's brilliant what you just said. Look, there's a great story years ago. So the reason I do so much service work is because I wasn't provided information as a young kid. Okay. So I can really identify with a kid that's in, before the internet, I'm in the most isolated capital city in the world, Perth, Western Australia. Everywhere I go, it's physical, mental abuse, but I believed intuitively I could get out. There wasn't a lot of books. There wasn't a lot of media, but I believe deep down, I'm like, I can figure that there's something that's calling me. I'm just going to take a risk and find the calling. So you got two kids. It's a great story. They're in the inner city. They're living with their dad, right? And the dad hits a ruckus and he goes to, you know, stop the neighbor, and the neighbor gets in an altercation. He goes back. He's trying to put the boys to sleep. They're 7 years old. He pulls out a shotgun. They get in an argument. He kills the guy. Both boys are separated, put into the foster system. 7 years later, they follow them. One of the kids is doing really well. The other kid gets in an argument with his foster sibling and stabs him to death. Okay. Fast forward 10 years. One is doing multiple life sentences.
Yeah.
The other kid has been a success. So they pulled him in different way. They followed them and they asked the guy that was in jail, what motivated him to have this life? And he said, do you know who my dad was? What choice did I have? That's a fair answer.
Right.
So they got the other kid that was a success. Same question. Do you know who my dad was? What choice did I have? Perception shift. Yeah. So one took the adversity and the negativity, powered him to be positive. That was me. I took everything negative. Now, was I born that way? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it was my calling to be that way. I don't know. Yeah. But what I do is I work with young kids that I went to a lockdown. I laid on the floor with them. I stayed in a room in this dorm with these kids. And young men need male role models.
Yeah.
Young men shoot up schools, not young girls. Because once the testosterone runs through our body, we get stuck in the primitive part of our brains. It's been proven that a young man's brain develops different to a young woman's.
Yeah,
right? The prefrontal cortex of a man takes a little longer than a woman. We act on emotion. We get emotionally hijacked. Women don't. They don't get as emotional and then act out because they don't have the testosterone. I'm not saying women don't get crazy, but you don't see a lift of women acting out violently. So when I work with a young man, the first thing I have to do is outwork him. And what I mean by that is, men want to be inspired by action, not by talk. And if I can get a kid and get him up at 4 a.m. and outrun him and outwork him out and just keep breaking him down, guess what? He's like, he's an old man, but he outruns me. He does all this stuff. And then what happens? I become a model of behavior that he somehow goes, okay, how is this guy always happy? How does he run like that? How does he exercise like that? Look, it's primitive. Let's look at it. Evolution. The strongest survive, right? I don't want to talk about Darwinism, but if we're impressed by physical attributes and people that actually move and do things. So I tap into the young man there and say, hey, I'm going to show you how you use your emotions. You're not going to act out. You're going to go run mindfully. You're going to eat correctly. You're going to be emotional intelligent. You're going to be of service. And if I get them young enough, then guess what? They don't act out racially. They don't bully other people. And you plant the seeds because they're young enough while the brain's still developing.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're saying that, because like, we work with youth as well in the treatment center we work at. And that's the thing is, you know, the world has become so, oh, you're acting out, here's a pill. Oh, you can't sleep, here's a pill. Oh, you can't wake up. Oh, you're too anxious, here's a pill. We're like, hey, why don't we try the diving board, a hike, like go up, walk up a mountain, like let's create some new behaviors and treat you like a teenager, you know, and something happens when you do that. And sadly, you know, like where we live, like Dan was talking about earlier, they're investing all this money in youth programs, but it's all clinical, you know, drop-in counseling therapy sessions. When I was 16, like I didn't need a therapist, you know, type of thing. And we're training our youth to do that. And it's sad, you know, it's all about building relationships and being a role model. And so I'm glad that you're doing that. We've got just a few minutes left here before we need to bring in our other guests. So about your books, what are some of those steps? Like, is somebody reading this book and it's like a exercise that they read and to learn?
The first book is based on 7 simple principles. I teach people to manage their breath and their fear, because I feel fear then triggers stress, and we live in a country full of stress. I don't think it's stress then fear. I think it's fear first. Then I teach people goal setting, emotional intelligence, positive psychology, which is based on Viktor Frankl's theory of you have to stress, right? It's not post-traumatic stress, it's post-traumatic growth. And I'm all about that.
On my nightstand right now, reading it.
Yeah. The greatest. I've read it like 8 times. That's what I always say. This is what I tell people. Viktor Frankl found positive psychology in Auschwitz. Okay?
Yeah.
Are you in Auschwitz? Suck it up. Do the work.
The first.
What would Viktor Frankl say? He'd say, suck it up. I'm eating maggots right now. Yeah. And you're chilling out in the sun. You see what I'm saying?
We need more of that influence, because I say it all the time. Hey, if I can do it, you can do it. And, you know, I remember feeling like the worst, I mean, I won't say it, piece of, you know, fill in the blank. When I finished reading that book, I just, any complaint, any type of whining and excuse making that I had just seemed like such a disrespect. And like, I mean, not to say that I've,
you know, what's funny is we're all laughing about it right now, but in the early days, it's like, it's true. You don't understand.
Life is so hard.
I think every kid I give that book to, I think it's one of the greatest books written. When you talk about a simple read of someone that took the adversity, but think about this. You have a guy like Hitler that went through resentments and acted out on a massive scale and tried to destroy the world. You have a guy like Viktor Frankl that suffered from that, became a positive psychologist and lived to 97. Like, he's a goddamn legend. He's like the greatest human being that ever lived. How do you even take that adversity and go, I'm going to flip it. I'm going to have purpose. I'm going to help people.
So the worst thing we can do is ignore and avoid and block out that reality that actually happened, that someone can overcome that much and turn it around and live an authentic and joyous life. And I'm just so afraid right now that I'm just going to not even think about that, focus on how hard my life is. So at this point, like, just open ourselves up to all of those influences of positivity and people's change and the experience of resiliency, really.
Yeah, I call it an indirect mentor. Someone that's not direct, because if you were talking to me and you, we're direct mentors. Indirect mentor is looking at someone's life, looking at your own, and then looking at a blueprint, because there's always a blueprint, and keeping it so small and saying, okay, I am only going to think of what they would do. How did they get through it? And you switch your perception. Now, neurons that fire together wire together, right? The more you think it, the more you feel it, the more you become it.
Love it. Yeah, I love it. Mike Diamond.
Darren, I got one more question.
Okay,
go.
So Mike, I like asking this. So you're in recovery. You're new in recovery. You're hyped on life. You got the personality where you can do a bit more than just share at a meeting and do service and a fellowship. So you're now got 200 speaking engagements and you're a recovery coach and trying to balance, you know, being of service and recovery and also being a successful person in business and writing books and doing speaker engagements. How do you, because a lot of people that watch our show, you know, everybody wants to be a blogger. Everybody wants their story to be a movie. You know, how, any advice out there? Like, how do you manage it and stay sane and not have an ego and humility in it all? And you know, if you become successful, dealing, like, sometimes being successful is a problem. So any tips, any advice? Did you go through any of that?
Yeah, I get up at 4 a.m. I meditate every day, no matter how I feel. Oh, I work out every day.
Okay.
I set massive goals. I close the gap. I have a very core group of people that keep me in check. My work in sobriety is not about me. My work in sobriety, whether I write, is to inspire, educate, motivate, live, love, and matter. So the first part is to inspire, educate, motivate, then show people how to live, love, and matter. And I can only be of service. My sobriety was given to me when I turned my life and will over to my higher power. So I get out of my own way and I listen to my higher power every morning. Then if I'm supposed to write something, what happens? I write a book in 6 weeks. That's not my book, so I will give that book away. I'm not going to make money off the book. I will find the right publisher that I'm dealing with now, and I'll give it to education, whatever, because that's not mine. That is mine to give. Do you know what I mean? So I keep it that green, because I'll tell you why. I did the rock clubs. I did the sex. I made the money. I make a great living, don't get me wrong. But I know the difference between when I have to be of service and when I have to speak, or when I have to do podcasts, when I have to do everything. You see what I'm saying? Like, I know, and I'm very clear. I can live the, look, I'm recession proof right now. You know why? Because I can live this life till I'm 90. I'm chilling. I can write and be of service and help people. My life is great. People need help, I'll go out and help more. People that are negative, you know what? I'll make it more positive.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah, it's what we needed to hear right now. It's what I needed to hear. Appreciate you and what you're doing. Check out the website, themikediamond.com. You got Facebook, Twitter. We'll have this all posted up on the Facebook live feed. Thanks a lot for dropping by. I hope we get to talk to you again soon, Mike.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
So we're still we're live on Facebook, and if you're listening to 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio, we are a week behind, but thanks for tuning in, everyone. Let's go right into our second guest. We have joining us today, Dr. Nancy Campbell. How are you?
I'm doing just fine here from upstate New York.
Okay, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Yeah, hi Nancy, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. Talk Recovery Radio is powered by New West Recovery, Canada's recovery community. So we're bringing in our second guest, Nancy. We found your book, and I love the title. I was like, "Who? What is that about?" That was my first reaction. OD, naloxone, and the politics of overdose. I'm not just a little radio DJ host show. You know, I got a little bit of advocacy in my blood. It started, you know, with Pride Day when I was like 15 in a small town. And, that movement still needs a lot of energy, and I still participate in that movement. Once I got into recovery, I didn't even know that there was politics around addiction and recovery, and which is something a lot of people don't know until their family experiences it. And I was in Portugal, I'm doing a documentary on drug policy, and I remember talking to one of the key people in Portugal's drug policy. And I said, "Does everybody in Portugal know about the Portuguese model and know like just how, you know, how North America talks about it every day?" And he's like, "No, they don't, unless they need us. They don't even know that until they need it." And so your book, why did you find the need to, you know, have to write it, I guess, is the first question. And because, like I say, the layman folks, they have no idea that there even is politics. So unless they see a social media feed. So what gave you the ambition and the drive to need to write the book?
Yeah, so I actually have written many books about the politics of substance abuse research, addiction research, and the sort of science, the politics of treatment, which, as you know, is often very hardball politics, because people become really committed to certain modalities and not others. And so when I was actually following naloxone and naloxone access advocates around, because I had written a history of buprenorphine, of Suboxone, which one of the activists said to me, "Hey, you know, you wrote a lot about buprenorphine, but not about naloxone." And of course, Suboxone combines both bup and naloxone. And I thought, you know, that's true. And I'm curious about naloxone because naloxone is a narcotic antagonist. And that means that throughout the history that I tell, which is usually 20th century, people have had different imaginations for what a narcotic antagonist could do. Some people have thought, oh, you know what, if we combine this with an opioid, then we'll make it so that people won't get any rush, any kick at all from heroin or whatever opioid we combine it with. Other people have thought we could use naloxone maybe to kind of inoculate people against relapse. Other people have thought you could use naloxone just to detect who is or isn't, quote, an addict. And so I was really interested in all these different dreams about what naloxone could be. And of course, I was most interested in this kind of naloxone, Narcan, right? The kind of naloxone that you give to someone in order to prevent a completely preventable death. And so I began to get interested in that politics, the politics of when do we say we as a society can prevent a preventable death and when don't we? And so that's what really got me interested in overdose and in the kinds of things that were happening in the movement, right? And this is a movement that the harm reduction movement, right, that grew out of the HIV and AIDS movement. It grew out of many movements for social change, where people are thinking, hey, let's think about health disparities. Let's think about the kind of inequality that gets expressed in who lives and who dies. And who do we decide and when do we decide and who decides that we ought to prevent preventable deaths? So embarking on this project, it took me 7 years. I talked to a lot of different people who were coming from really different perspectives. I often ran into people who said, "Well, I'm in recovery, and I not harm reduction, right? I don't go there." But I got really interested in the end of the book and in the end of the process about people who were combining harm reduction and recovery, and they were really creating something new, a kind of hybrid movement in which the two movements converged. So that's how I got into it, and that's kind of where I ended up with it. But there's a lot along the way that we can
talk about. There's a lot along the way. I can tell you this is exactly so. I had a conversation were in Canada. So I had a conversation with Health Canada 2 weeks ago. We organized Recovery Month, Recovery Day. And what's happened is there's this, I don't know if you can, this is what you found too. Like 20 years ago, it was like do recovery or die. And you couldn't talk about harm reduction, not even in Ottawa. And over the years, harm reduction became a movement, and an unintended consequence is almost like a reversal. It's, you know, harm reduction or die. And recovery, like it's almost a radioactive word when it comes to Health Canada. Like, and trust me, like I had this really bizarre experience where, you know, they just put a guideline for everyone in Canada on, you know, substance use and COVID, and the word recovery was on page 57.
Wow.
And like, why is it on page one or at least two? And so that was our petition. It's like, how do we, there's like microaggressions. It's like the recovery community is just as guilty about saying harm reduction. And harm reduction, there's this like, well, you know, it's not evidence-based enough. And it's like, well, you know, there's only millions of people in recovery. And so how do we, you've done some research, you've done lots of conversations, and maybe this could even be advice for me. How do we break down the very thick walls of these silos where you're either in harm reduction or you're in recovery or you're a harm reduction cloaked in abstinence-based recovery clothing, which I heard somebody tell me. It's bizarre. So
I love that construct, though. It's not one I've heard. It's a new one. The sort of wolf in sheep's clothing.
Exactly. Yeah. I was just like, whoa, I'm going to hashtag that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. So that is a real question. And the answers vary. In the United States, we have this kind of notion. Harm reduction was really a dirty word in the United States from the Reagan administration on. And it took a long, long time to create the world that we're in now, where everyone says they're a harm reductionist. And that's all very interesting for me. I'm a historian, so I look at the long term. And so having studied this movement, moving in this 20-year period, right, from harm reduction being a dirty word to we are all harm reductionists, except that when you really kind of scratch the surface, right, you see that there are still a lot of walls. There are still these kinds of walls that are around, do we have a recovery-oriented treatment infrastructure in the United States? And not really, not as much as, you know, we should probably. Do we have trauma-informed treatment infrastructure in the United States? Probably, again, not really. We don't think as well as we might about inequities in health and health infrastructure in the US. And three chapters of my book are about the UK, mainly Scotland and England. And again, the politics of recovery are really different in those places, where they're often aligned with much more conservative and less of the harm reduction oriented, because in those places, the NHS has harm reduction kind of integrated into it, which we do not have in the US. So it was really hard, these words and the politics of them, the ideas behind them, and the feeling, the affect, right, of what it means to be in long-term recovery, what it means to be in a community of harm reductionists, that really does vary quite a bit between Scotland, England, the US, and I'm sure Canada. I didn't kind of touch Canada in my book because I always think of you and Canada as having it together.
No.
And having... having harm reduction and having a recovery.
It's Canada, my perspective and my personal experience is if you have money, you are going to be able to access the best of the best recovery oriented system of care. If you don't have money, then you will have access to the best of the best harm reduction services. And me and many other colleagues across the country are like bringing to light that, and people just don't know. And they don't know that if you're a doctor or a nurse, in this country, you get, you know, funded recovery oriented systems of care. But if you're a patient of that doctor or nurse and you are on welfare, you get a condom and needle and directions to a consumption site. And people, I keep saying that every chance I get, you can ask Darren, because people don't know that. Then they're like, oh, wait a minute, I didn't know that. It's like, why don't you have the same access your doctor does? So, you know, have you ever heard of Dr. David Best in the UK?
Yes, of course. I write about him. He's in my book.
No, he is. Perfect. Yeah. I've become friends with Dr. David Best and his science on recovery communities. And so I'm glad that you talked. So recovery as a contagion, did you ever hear any of that chatter from him?
I didn't actually talk to him. I looked at everything he wrote. Because part of what I was really interested in was this idea that I call evidence-based activism. So okay. One of the things that happened for this movement, and if you think back to HIV/AIDS and, you know, something like ACT UP Treatment and Data Committee that kind of activism, in which the activists become the experts and they become highly educated and very knowledgeable. And they're able to, you know, give you all of the studies, all of the citations, all of the evidence. Well, that lesson of evidence-based activism was really put into practice in the naloxone access movement, because they had to produce evidence and they had to work with scientists and clinicians from the ground up. In other words, they you know, wanted to get this drug out there, right? That was something that could save people's lives. And they wanted people who weren't medically trained to have access to it. They wanted people, in a sense, anyone who would witness, who was likely to witness an overdose. They wanted anybody to have it. Mm-hmm. And that conflicts, you know, really directly with all of the ways in which prescription drugs are governed. Naloxone to this day in the United States is not an over-the-counter drug, right? It is something you can go into many pharmacies and get, but again, it's, do you have health insurance and do you have money? Or do you get it through your harm reduction organization, which is funded in some way that they can give out clean needles or they can give out naloxone, but access is not universal. It is striated and stratified in just the way that you were suggesting, even access to recovery or even effective treatment is stratified.
I have one more question, and then I know Darren's got some questions too. I want to talk a little bit about controversy, and then from an academic point of view, I'd love to hear your response. I don't agree with these comments, but they're out there. Naloxone fuels addiction. Naloxone needs to be followed up with treatment. And I brought up recovery as a contagion because, you know, is addiction, you know, if you're supporting the addiction, are we creating more addiction? And why we have the downtown east side and other parts of the states have their own. What do you say about that?
Right. So this is naloxone and harm reduction. I mean, these are contentious politics. And believe it or not, that's a technical term. People who study social movements look at the contentious politics of something like addiction or recovery or naloxone. And so I was kind of thinking about naloxone as, yes, it's very contentious. And the ideas, right? The idea, for instance, that to have naloxone means that you're condoning drug use or you're condoning addiction or feeding addiction came up quite often. In fact, this evidence-based stuff, right? The fact that all these scientific researchers start producing studies often to contradict or counteract those kinds of ideas, those kinds of misrecognitions of what having naloxone means people do. So there are many studies showing now that people still call the ambulance. People still try to, don't try to overdo it or so-called push the envelope if they have naloxone. In the US, I don't know whether you have these in Canada or not, there was a myth of Narcan parties and the idea that people would do more drug if they had naloxone than if they didn't have naloxone, right? The study after study has been created in because people want to counteract those kinds of really dangerous myths that getting something out that will prevent death is somehow putting people in danger. And so a lot of the activists who I follow did things to try to counteract those kinds of statements, particularly often coming from conservative political factions who are very anti-drug, but they're really orthodox oriented. They're orthodoxy oriented. And by that, I mean, the only way to do it is abstinence only, right? And so there's nothing like harm reduction in that way of thinking. And so the people who try to get naloxone out there really tried to figure out, well, how do we make good arguments that stand up in the political arena, as well as in science and medicine, as well as in the sort of moral arena, that all drugs, everything that we do about drugs or harm reduction or recovery always has a moral punch to it, right? It's always about morality and about public morality and about the politics that are behind public moralities.
And it seems like an argument or a fight that doesn't get any conclusion to it. Yeah. I'm curious, I don't know if you began your research or you know, in writing this book from a, you know, an unbiased position, was there anything that you learned that surprised you, that changed your mind and your perspective on how, you know, things should be?
Yeah, definitely. And it's exactly what we're talking about today. I was most surprised when I walked into a place in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, called RAISE, Recovery Advocacy and Services and Education, the RAISE Project. I walk into the RAISE Project. I know that this is a group of people who are all in long-term recovery. Every employee of the RAISE Project is in long-term recovery. I've met the founder of the RAISE Project, and I walk in and everybody, you know, I'm thinking recovery. I had that idea, right, that people who were in long-term recovery were not going to be friendly to harm reduction. We're not going to be friendly to medication-assisted treatment. Or they actually call it something else. They call it medication-assisted recovery services. And so at the RAISE Project, everybody has naloxone on their desk. Everybody does trainings to train people how to use it, supplies people, equips people. They don't make that old-fashioned really distinction between being in recovery and preventing preventable deaths. And so that was such a surprise to me, and it was such a refreshing like here, Professor Campbell, all your ideas about how opposed harm reduction and recovery are have just been turned upside down. And that was a really hopeful, optimistic sign, I thought, the convergence between recovery and harm reduction.
And that's, you know, leading into the next question, because, I mean, we've been talking about it for years. I got clean 14 years ago after years of struggle, in and out, treatment centers. you know, at that point, there was a few times an introduction to methadone option. Mm-hmm. But when I got clean, it was cold turkey. I was in a treatment center. And of course, very easily, I could claim the abstinent, complete stake in the ground and hold firm to that. But as time goes by, things change. And we talk about the absolute necessity for harm reduction options. Especially, you know, the vulnerable, you know, poverty-stricken areas, but it lacks that connect to the next, you know, form of resource, the opportunity for one of those individuals to become abstinent in a safe place, in a safe environment with therapy, and what did you learn is the block? Is it dollars? Is it like what is it keeping that? Because it just seems like an obvious solution and a real 1+1=2 equation.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's I think harm reduction recovery, however you want to talk about that. I think Chicago Recovery Alliance, for instance, has a really good way of talking about recovery as any positive change, right? The problem in my mind with abstinence only recovery is that it's abstinence only, and it's an orthodoxy and it's an absolute. And so that means that if anybody slips, if there's any kind of relapse, that's over. And I think that's a really problematic place for any human being to be in. I think that harm reduction gives you a continuum. It gives you that idea that even small steps are steps. And it gives you a real sense that we could live more livable lives, right? That the movement is not just about preventing preventable deaths, but that it's also about living more livable lives. And sometimes a livable life doesn't mean living in absolute rejection, the big no. Yeah. So I think that there's a philosophical, and I use that word really advisedly, I think there's an emotional barrier that we have to get over, right? If we're going to see these worlds as colliding and converging in interesting hybrid kinds of ways, we have to get over that barrier. And sometimes that keeps people strong, right? Sometimes that barrier keeps people.
On this topic, we're going to end up going a bit over time, but I want to ask you this question. I agree with what you just said. The conversation we're trying to have is here, and they're doing the same in the States, I'm assuming, everybody's making all the service providers fit in this one square. Like, it's like, you all need to provide the wellness wheel harm reduction model. And some people are smart, some people are Narcotics Anonymous, some providers are Alcoholics Anonymous, some providers are non-12-step. You know, the non-12-step based treatment industry is skyrocketed, some of them charging $700 a day because there's a market for it. Because when your kid's like, "Mom, I don't want to go to 12-step meetings," the mom's frantically on Google, you know, non-12-step has become a huge search word in the industry. You know, people that are in it for the money have figured out, well, I'm just going to call my treatment center non-12-step and charge $700 a day. And they're popping up everywhere. And so that's another unintended consequence. So we are going to some government officials and saying, "Hey, we don't all fit in the same square." And there's people that, like, I remember when I first went to treatment, I was given, you know, this underground, under the table conversation. This is where you go to get clean. This is where you go where you can use. This is where you can go and use every day and they don't care. This is where you go and you do yoga. And so you make that, you know, it was all under the table, hush, hush. And that conversation has been going on for decades. So we're like, "Hey, why don't we just accept that and give the client the choice? Like, this is where you go, where you can use every day. And, you know, full support you. This is where you go where your roommate's not going to be using drugs. And, like, I want to go to a place where my roommate, you know, hopefully will not be using drugs." No guarantees, obviously. And so that's kind of the way we're going, where it's just like, you've got a place where, you know, Narcotics Anonymous isn't the program, but it's based on their program. And this is, you know, that's what they do, the unity and all that. How do we get to a place? Because this is what they do in Portugal. In Portugal, there's no... You want to go to therapeutic community for 2 years? Go. You want to go to a CBT program? Go. You know, the assessment isn't, it's a bipartisan assessment. They're not attached to the treatment center. But we can't do that here. It's just like, no, you have, like, there's some places here where you can be in for 6 months. And if you even question the idea of tapering off your dose of methadone or Suboxone, you'll be asked to leave. So we created this industry where it's just like, it's absolutes everywhere. So
yeah, what are your thoughts on that? Yeah. So I also write about the history of treatment. And one of the interesting things about what you just said, I wrote a book with co-authors called The Narcotic Farm, and wrote about the sort of legendary U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, that was a multimodality treatment center. And it was for 40 years, from 1935 to 1975. And then the idea of multimodality, had a brief flourish for a brief period of time in the U.S. During the early days of the Nixon administration. So Jerry Jaffe, who was the first drug czar under Nixon, and who really helped to scale up methadone in this country, ran a multimodality treatment center in Chicago. And so there have been times when this idea of multimodality has taken hold, but multimodality, no one thing is going to work for everyone. And a lot of people have to try different modalities, and sometimes many times before, they find something that really works for them and leads into a more long-term recovery state. And what's going to happen to them during that time? And that's harm reduction, right? So in a lot of ways, I think we have to kind of recycle some of those ideas and really think about what's multimodality, what does that mean, and who gets to decide, right? Who gets to choose? Does the patient or client, right, have the agency and autonomy to make those kinds of decisions? I mean, you were talking earlier about programs for impaired physicians and the ways in which those programs are much more successful than other programs. And, you've always got these kinds of debates. This will always be a contentious political arena. Treatment, recovery, always contentious politics. But the fact is, when you think about what politics is and who gets what and who gets to decide who gets what, right? That's what politics is. And I think those are the kinds of questions we really have to be asking ourselves as we're thinking about, well, how do we create a better treatment infrastructure than the current industry model?
That has been the question we've been asking for so long.
I'm like getting hot here. Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do. And our advocacy movements changed. I've been on the Recovery Day Committee for, I think, since 2012. And even our messaging's changing every year. And the harm reduction advocates, even their messaging is changing. So I think we're getting there. And Recovery Days, for those of you that are watching in BC, it's on September 5th. It's the same. Like, a lot of people used to ask, well, why do you have Pride Day? Like, what's the point? And it's exact same thing with Recovery Day. Why do you have Recovery Day? And then you go and you're like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that this conversation needs to be had louder. And so that's a goal of mine. Darren's a part of it as well. Thank you so much for all the research you've done, and your answers have been amazing and helping us, with our narrative here in Canada and so forth. Your book, OD, Naloxone, and the Politics of Overdose, one of many books that you have. You have a website, or where do people find your books?
So this book is from MIT Press, and it's called OD. The others, you can find them wherever books are sold, really. Any independent bookseller should be able to get most of them.
Okay.
Thank you for being on our show. Thank you very much. Darren, good to see you virtually.
Yes, that was Dr. Nancy Campbell. Again, thanks for showing up and being with us today on Talk Recovery, 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio. Thanks for tuning
Hopefully
in.
Hopefully we'll be in the studio soon. Until then, we'll see you on Facebook
My
Live.
Pleasure.
Take care. Thanks for listening, everyone.